The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's something you wouldn't expect about Kim Jong-il. He wasn't born on the divine slopes of Mount Paektu. He wasn't even born in Korea. He spent the first 4 years of his life living in the eastern stretches of the Soviet Union, a logging camp in Siberia, to be exact. According to Russian birth records, Kim Jong-il's name is actually Yuri Ersinovich Kim. It was 1941. The Korean Peninsula was occupied and controlled by Japan. And Kim's father, the future supreme leader Kim Il-sung, was a guerrilla freedom fighter, the leader of a ragtag platoon of communist soldiers fighting Japanese imperialists. But when World War II erupted, Kim Il-sung fled into the Soviet Union with a female soldier, a dogged fighter who had served as his bodyguard. Her name was Kim Jong-suk. According to people who knew her, Jong-suk was a warm-hearted but rugged and fearless woman. When she was a teenager, her family had been murdered by Japanese settlers. She had sworn revenge, joined the Korean cause, and met Kim Il-sung on the battlefield. She even saved the man's life from a deadly ambush. And it was during this time, in the early 40s, that Jong-suk and Kim Il-sung fell in love, became unofficially married, and had two boys, Yuri Ersinovich, lovingly nicknamed Yura, and his little brother, Chura. In Russia, the children received endless attention and affection. But in 1945, when Korea was liberated from Japan, the Kim family returned home. Kim Il-sung, who had ingratiated himself with Soviet leadership, was installed by Joseph Stalin as North Korea's chairman. For a young Kim Jong-il and his brother, leaving Russia was difficult. Their parents became busy and distant. Their dad was occupied trying to build a communist utopia, and their mother was often away, traveling the country as his political representative. And then, in September 1949, tragedy struck. Kim Jong-suk was pregnant, and Kim Jong-il, just 8 years old, waited in the palace for his mom to bring home a baby sister. Hours later, a family member arrived, tears streaming down her cheeks. Kim Jong-il was told to prepare, instead, for a funeral. The baby had been lost. And so, too, had his mother. Kim Jong-il panicked. He sprinted out the door in the direction of the hospital. Guards swooped in and grabbed him. As an officer lugged him back into the house, the little boy began wailing uncontrollably, calling out for his mother. At the funeral, Kim Jong-il was inconsolable. He clung to his dead mother's body and wept in her arms. When a group of elders tried to lead the boy away, his father stopped them, saying,
"Leave him alone. Tomorrow he will have no mother anymore in whose embrace to cry."
Little did the boy know, but the supreme leader was already thinking about his wife's replacement. A grieving Kim Jong-il would watch with jealousy as his father built a new family around a new woman, growing even more distant from his eldest son. That's the strange thing about the stories of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-nam. The two generations share an eerie parallel. Both, in one way or another, would lose their mothers in childhood. And both would spend the rest of their lives fighting these other new families for the love and attention of their father, the supreme leader. The result would be a series of cruel family games, of manipulative infighting that would do much more than alter the dynamic inside the gilded palaces of Pyongyang. It would change the course of world history. My name is Eden Lee, and in this episode, the tale of two generations of Kims vying for power in a world of subterfuge, espionage, and deceit, and the mistake that may have cost Kim Jong-nam the crown and his life.
She takes a gun away and she says, "You're not getting any stupid ideas. Be a man and go forth and lead your country."
In East Asia, people around the court like to go on and on about which branch has what it takes to be the leading branch of the family.
I think that it was due to the mothers that the succession decision was made.
This is Big Brother. While Kim Jong-il's mother had died in childbirth, Kim Jong-nam's mother, you may remember, was still alive. She was exiled to a mental facility in Russia, leaving the young Kim Jong-nam effectively motherless and a state secret. And then in 1980, when the boy was 9 years old, his father agreed to send him to a boarding school abroad. Here's journalist Anna Fifield.
Kim Jong-nam was living this very abnormal life. You know, he didn't go to school in North Korea. He was confined to one of these palatial compounds. And his grandmother actually said, you know, this is no way for a kid to live. So the first idea was to go off to the Soviet Union, to Moscow.
But Kim Jong-nam was no fan of Russia. Like a true spoiled prince, he whined constantly. His biggest complaint? How dirty the Soviet Union's toilets were. So at the behest of his uncle, Chang Sung-taek, the boy was sent to Switzerland.
Chang Sung-taek had found out that lots of celebrities sent their children to the school in Geneva. A Thai princess, Michael Douglas, had all gone to this school in Geneva.
So Kim Jong-nam moved to Switzerland to attend the International School of Geneva, one of the most diverse academies on the planet. The institution overflowed with the sons and daughters of wealthy dignitaries and diplomats from all over the world, and even boasted alumni such as Indira Gandhi. Kim's cousin and playmate, Lee Nam-ok, came with him. The two received fake names and fake passports. They were given alibis and told everybody they were the children of diplomats. To avoid bumping into nosy South Korean students who were usually enrolled in English-speaking classes, the two cousins took courses in French. It's worth noting, they did not speak French. One of those nosy South Korean students, by the way, happened to be Dr. Sung Yoon Lee, professor at Tufts University.
Many years ago, I enrolled at the International School of Geneva, Switzerland, sometime in September 1980.
Not only did Dr. Lee attend the same school, he attended at the same time as Kim Jong-nam.
I enrolled on the very same day. Kim Jong-nam was 3 years younger than I, so we never were in the same classroom, hardly ever crossed paths. But the South Korean ambassador, to the United Nations in Geneva mistook Kim Jong-nam as a South Korean student and struck up a conversation with Kim Jong-nam, and the North Korean princeling said, "I'm actually from North Korea."
To say the least, the regime would have its hands full keeping Kim Jong-nam a secret. North Korea watched the potential successor closely. Even his cousin, Lee Nam-ok, enrolled in the same classes just to keep a protective eye on him.
Even though she was 5 years older than him, she, you know, went to his class. She was denied a normal upbringing. She was always 5 years behind there with him.
The regime even rented a fifth-floor apartment across the street to monitor the princeling. But constant surveillance couldn't stop the fact that Kim Jong-nam would be exposed to everything Europe offered. A mixed economy, a free press, and a vast expanse of art, culture, and different ways of thinking. For years, this Western playground distracted him from the gossip of Pyongyang, namely, that his father was building a new family with a new stepmom and two younger half-brothers. Instead, Kim Jong-nam spent his teenage years in blissful ignorance. And as he hobnobbed with the richest and most privileged children in the world, he became something of a snotty playboy. At school, Kim Jong-nam befriended the children of famous French singers. He went for joyrides in Mercedes-Benzes with moneyed Arab princes. He let loose on the Riviera with hotel heiresses and skied the Alps with kids who had their own Swiss bank accounts. He partied and snorted drugs. He bought booze with his fake ID and drained the bottles by night. He slept with women and lost count of how many. And then in 1989, it all came crashing to an end. Kim Jong-nam turned 18, and his father demanded that he return to Pyongyang. When he arrived, residence number 15 was boiling with gossip.
Kim Jong-il had children with another woman, and then Kim Jong-il's affections were then showered upon that family.
To put it lightly, the two branches of the family were not getting along.
This is something that seems to have really emotionally scarred Kim Jong-nam, and he felt cast aside.
Residence number 15, according to Anna Fifield, seethed with rivalry. As she wrote in her book, The Great Successor, quote, "They were convinced that the other woman was a manipulative shrew who was poisoning Kim Jong-il against them. They talked about whether the woman was fat and derided her as half Jap. They even concocted vicious nicknames for the stepmother, calling her Pangchiko, a slur that means hammer nose, but with a twist, referencing the gambling game pachinko to snipe at her Japanese roots. But insults couldn't heal the hurt. When Kim Jong-nam was sent to Europe, his branch of the family had become an afterthought. Now they felt second class, neglected, and the implications were obvious. The situation harmed Kim Jong-nam's political future. But for those close to the Kim family, this drama wasn't anything unusual. It was just deja vu. Because decades earlier, when Kim Jong-il was a little boy, similar complaints were swirling in the palace air. After the death of his mom, his dad had come home with a new mistress. And with this new woman in the picture, his political future had been at risk, too. The story of how Kim Jong-il clawed his way to the top when we return.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truth be told, Kim Jong-il had a tenuous relationship with his father long before this other woman stepped in. And that's because of a traumatic event that took place when Kim Jong-il, then known as Yura, was just a little boy. It's 1947. Yura and his little brother, Shura, are playing alone near the edge of a pond. Yura is around 6. Shura, 4. The boys grapple and horseplay around the shallows, splashing and dunking each other's heads under the surface. Yura lifts himself out of the water. But when little Shura tries to climb out, Yura, the bullying big brother, playfully pushes him back in. The boys laugh, and then Shura tries to get out a second time. But Yura shoves him right back into the murky lagoon. Yura teases his little brother and continues the cruel game again. And again. And again. Minutes later, the supreme leader rushes to the pond and finds a young Kim Jong-il standing awkwardly at the water's edge.
What's the matter? What's the matter?
He repeats the question over and over. But little Kim Jong-il is speechless.
I'm asking you what this is all about. Look at me. Look at me.
Kim Jong-il just stands there, his face to the ground, burrowed in shame.
What have you been doing, Yura?
Just offshore, floating in the water, is the lifeless body of his little brother. Kim Jong-il's official biography makes no mention of his dead brother. But documents captured by American soldiers after the Korean War show that Kim Il-sung was so heartbroken that he invited Buddhist monks and a shaman to pray at the site of the drowning. According to a defector close to the Kim family, young Kim Jong-il would spend the following years a, quote, lonely and guilty child, quiet, depressed, and fearful of what his father thought of him. The dual tragedy of losing his brother and mother would forever alter Kim Jong-il's relationship with his father, who had already started a separate family with a new woman and new sons. And that's what sparked a competition that would reshape the politics of North Korea. You see, during the DPRK's infancy, Kim Il-sung was more likely to pass power to a fellow comrade rather than his kids. The whole concept of hereditary succession was anathema to communist teaching. In fact, the North Korean Dictionary of Political Terminologies lambasted the practice, quote,
"Hereditary succession is a reactionary custom of exploitative societies. Originally a product of slave societies, it was later adopted by feudal lords as a means to perpetuate dictatorial rule."
But then, at some point, Kim Il-sung changed his mind. By the mid-1960s, the Supreme Leader made it clear that power would remain in the family. Kim Jong-il, of course, was the first and eldest son. By Confucian tradition, the throne should have been his. But his spot wasn't guaranteed. Kim Il-sung clearly preferred his two youngest sons over his firstborn. Kim Jong-il felt the odds were stacked against him. And since his brother and mother were dead, he didn't have many advocates in the regime. So he deployed a plan. At the time, there was no true single-party rule yet. Multiple communist groups were jockeying for influence. Kim Il-sung knew that the stability of the country and his pursuit of power depended on consolidating their support. He gave impassioned speeches, like the one you're hearing now, to rally groups behind his leadership. Here's Michael Madden.
Kim Il-sung, when he first became leader in 45, he had to contend with different factions of nationalist Koreans. Kim Il-sung doesn't have ultimate power, so his whole pursuit from 1945 to 1950 is basically to dominate the North Korean political system.
Kim Il-sung's strategy centered on a combination of hard and soft power by both cracking skulls and poisoning minds. When he wasn't eliminating traitors through bloodshed, the leader was focusing his attention on winning people's trust. He enlisted advisors to boost his reputation as a person whose wisdom, knowledge, and power were unmatched. All of a sudden, peddling propaganda became a way to win favor with the leader. A palatial arms race ensued. Who could praise and idolize the supreme leader the most? This was Kim Jong-il's wheelhouse. As a lover of theater and movies, he was a master of artifice. He churned out films and news articles depicting his father not just as a wise and compassionate strongman, but as all-knowing. Kim Jong-il, in other words, would help transform his father into a living god. As part of this, Kim Jong-il made everybody in North Korea wear lapel pins of his father's face. He built dozens of mansions for his dad and funneled millions of dollars into erecting statues of his likeness. And so, Kim Il-sung the man became Kim Il-sung the legend. And the leader relished the attention. As more people praised him, the more the personality cult grew into a cartoonish mythology. The history books literally changed. Kim Il-sung transformed from a meager guerrilla fighter to the beating heart of the resistance movement, the man who had single-handedly liberated the country, and people believed it. In 1979, journalist Bradley Martin visited North Korea for the World Table Tennis Championships. He realized that North Korea operated with a peculiar piety.
When I first went there, it clearly was a religious state. The people worshiped Kim Il-sung.
And in his opinion, it was sincere.
The worship was not purely a matter of their submitting to government, but they wanted to worship him. They loved him, and I detected very little falsity in the expressions of praise, and it was very much a religious state.
Kim Jong-il's propaganda efforts would change the face of North Korea, and they put him back in his father's good graces. But it still didn't guarantee that he'd inherit the throne. The one thing standing in Kim Jong-il's way was his new stepmother, who was positioning her firstborn son, named Kim Kyung-il, as the successor.
In East Asia, people around the court like to go on and on about which branch has what it takes to be the leading branch of the family. That was pretty much as it was with Kim Jong-il and his brother, Kim Pyong-il, his rival.
Kim Pyong-il was a terrifying opponent. He was the spitting image of their father. He had a much more affectionate relationship with him, too. And no amount of flattering publicity could replace the fact that Kim Il-sung spent his nights sleeping next to Pyong Il's mother. Propaganda was no match for pillow talk. Kim Jong-il realized that in order to become the frontrunner, he'd have to do more than boost his father into the image of a god. To destroy his little brother's prospects, he'd have to eliminate the power of the other woman. Two decades later, Kim Jong-nam would face a similar challenge with his stepmother. When he returned from Europe, the dynamics of palace life had changed. His father, once so loving, hardly visited residence number 15 anymore. It was as if the Jongnam side of the family didn't exist. Kim Jong-il's other family included a 5-year-old son, Kim Jong-un, and their father devoted all of his free time and energy to this little boy. But what really shocked and dismayed Kim Jong-nam's branch of the family was how brazen his father's new mistress, Ko Young-hee, was acting.
Up until this point, Kim Jong-il's wives were to run the household. They were not to be involved in politics. He changes his mind about that with Ko Young-hui.
As Michael Madden explains, Ko shamelessly inserted herself into politics.
Ko Young-hui is allowed to talk to the political aides that come by the house to brief Kim Jong-il. That's where Ko Young-hui starts to attain a degree of political importance. She's a close steward, a selection of Kim Jong-il's top guys.
To Kim Jong-nam's side of the family, Ko Young-hee was just manipulating the man. She was nothing but a gold digger, an illegitimate concubine, unworthy of the title of wife. And she was part Japanese, North Korea's sworn enemy. And so, to Kim Jong-nam's family, her kids weren't successors. They were illegitimate children and thus illegitimate heirs. But like the generation before him, Kim Jong-nam's mother was out of the picture.
Kim Jong-nam's mother had basically had a mental breakdown and gone to Moscow and stayed abroad for almost the rest of her life. And so she was literally out of the inner circle. She was far away. She didn't have much influence.
Ko Young-hee, on the other hand,
Kim Jong-un's mother, she was very much in the inner circle. She was at Kim Jong-il's side. She was making decisions. She was advising him. And she had been trying to position both of her sons as the heir apparent to Kim Jong-il. So she did things like making sure that they both got the military uniforms and were called little generals, just like Kim Jong-nam was. She made sure that they went into like the North Korean equivalent of West Point so that they had that military training and they could justify leading a country that had a military-first policy. She was actively lobbying for them behind the scenes. I think that it was due to the mothers that the succession decision was made.
And Ko Young-hee knew a thing or two about getting on the leader's good side. In fact, in 1992, she became one of the most important people in the regime. At that point, Kim Jong-il had taken the reins of decision-making, with his father remaining a mere figurehead. But one day, Kim Jong-il was riding a horse when he fell off and suffered a severe head injury. It was so bad that the regime flew in a neurologist from France. According to Michael Madden, with her husband incapacitated, Ko Young-hee stepped in.
During that point, Ko Young-hui basically starts helping him with paperwork that's coming into the house.
And so, for a whole year, Ko Young-hee acts as Kim Jong-il's top advisor. And then, when Kim Jong-il officially becomes supreme leader, she saves her husband's life a second time.
Ko Young-hui goes by a room in one of the houses and sees Kim Jong-il cleaning his gun. Kim Jong-il is going to shoot himself in the head and commit suicide. She takes a gun away,
And she says, you're not getting any stupid ideas. Be a man and go forth and lead the country. So this is where Kim Jong-un's mother is sort of endeared to the leader, where she becomes a political force and a political influence.
This is where Kim Jong-nam's path diverges from his father's. Kim Jong-il prevented his stepfamily from stealing the successorship by, well, sucking up to his father. It was filial piety on steroids. But when Kim Jong-nam's stepmother interfered, he rebelled. Rather than elevate his father's image, he escaped his royal compound and drank his way across Pyongyang.
There was a period of time when Kim Jong-nam was in his 20s and was essentially kind of locked in this gilded cage in Pyongyang. You know, he was this young guy wanting to be, you know, socializing and having fun and things, and he wasn't able to do that in Pyongyang. So him and his cousin, Ri Nam Ok, would go out in one of the regime Mercedes, you know, at nighttime, go joyriding around the place and kind of burn off a little steam.
And word spread fast. Pyongyang's elite complained that Kim Jong-nam was a belligerent and obnoxious drunk. He made people bow when he entered a room. One time, the drunken prince entered a hotel lobby, pulled out a pistol, and littered the ceiling with bullet holes, all because somebody had taken his parking space. There's speculation that these stories aren't actually true. But in Pyongyang, that didn't matter. These rumors were circulating, and they were making Kim Jong-il look bad. So when he found out, he went berserk.
Kim Jong-il was extremely angry about this and basically put them under house arrest in their compound in Pyongyang. He denied food to them. They had to live on what they had, and, you know, they were really cut off and punished as a result of this.
Kim Jong-nam's father even threatened to send his son and extended family to a labor camp. But nobody in residence number 15 blamed the young prince. They blamed his stepmother. According to Jongnam's cousin, Yi Nam-ok, quote, the other woman's fingerprints were all over this.
There is a suggestion, yeah, that it was Kim Jong-un's mother who tipped off Kim Jong-il and tried to make them look bad.
Gossip spread that it was actually the stepmother who had snitched on Jongnam. As Fifield writes in her book, Ko Young-hee had, quote, encouraged Kim Jong-il to allow his oldest son more freedom, then ratted on the young man when he enjoyed that freedom. The family was convinced that this other woman would do anything to tarnish the reputation of the man competing with her sons. In his mid-20s, Kim Jong-nam did clean up his act and began joining his father on official summits, even accompanying him on a trip to Mount Paektu. In 1997, he began studying economics, a sign that he was destined for big things, and was given a military post. Here's Bradley Martin.
When Kim Jong-nam was 24, his father presented him a general's uniform. Everybody started calling him general. That seems to me a pretty good indication that he was at least being thought of as the successor.
And at the same time, Kim Jong-nam was awarded the freedom to travel beyond the palace walls. He adventured to Japan and Beijing, where some suggest he indulged in women and illicit activities, as well as official business. Everywhere he went, he traveled with a fake passport under a fake name. By 1998, things were looking up. Kim Jong-nam was elected as a delegate to North Korea's legislature. He even got to flex his muscles as a computer whiz.
He was active in getting the Korean Computer Center started up and in the import of computers. And he had a position which is now called the Ministry of Social Security. Those are pretty high-end positions as far as the North Korean regime of that day.
This latter position at the State Security Ministry was an important one. Kim Jong-nam had the tough job of handling defectors and refugees, and it gave him an opportunity to show his soft side.
There was an incident around 1998 where hundreds of North Koreans had fled into China to try to find food, which was highly illegal. These people were all detained, and then one day, they're all turned loose.
they all got pardoned. And they were told to thank Comrade Kim Jong-nam because Comrade Kim Jong-nam had exercised his benevolence on their behalf and forgiven these hungry people.
In the words of a human rights activist, the official party line was, "You owe all of this to Kim Jong-nam." By the millennium, it seemed that Kim Jong-nam had survived his roaring 20s, had survived the manipulations of his stepmother. He was building a name for himself in the regime. And then, in 2001, this happened.
Tokyo Disneyland.
Disneyland.
Taking his son to Disneyland.
Kim Jong-nam got caught going to Disneyland.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll get back to Mickey Mouse later. The very fact that Kim Jong-nam's political prospects ever survived the 1990s despite his gun-toting, beer-guzzling, sex-loving reputation is remarkable. Because that's exactly what helped bring down Kim Jong-il's half-brother, Kim Pyong-il. Remember that rivalry? In the 1970s, Pyong-il was steadily climbing the ladder. He entered the bodyguard division of the Supreme Guard Command, graduated from Kim Il-sung University, was promoted to colonel, and named vice head of the Strategic Department of Bodyguards. All signs pointed to Kim Pyong-il as the supreme leader's favorite. It helped that his mother was still around to whisper encouraging words into Kim Il-sung's ear. But there was one problem. Kim Pyong-il was the life of the party. He drank, danced, and caroused with officers in the State Security Department and with bigwigs in the bodyguard units. He lived for elaborate gifts, engraved watches, and free drinks. Little did he know, Big Brother Kim Jong-il was spying on him. One day, at a party, a group of bodyguards started drunkenly praising the young potential heir, chanting,
"Long live Kim Jong-il! Long live Kim Jong-il!"
This was a dumb mistake. In a country where Kim Il-sung was a living god, only one person deserved a live-long chant. This was pure, unadulterated blasphemy. Word soon reached Kim Jong-il. As the state propaganda master, he knew these chants sounded like somebody trying to chip away at the supreme leader's allegiances.
Kim Jong-il was a better infighter than Kim Pyong-il. So he got some dirt on Kim Pyong-il and got the word to his father that Kim Pyong-il was parading around as if he were the successor designate, as if he were a big shot.
Kim Il-sung was outraged.
Pyong-il was quickly demoted. He went off and became a diplomat in Europe for his whole career.
And so Kim Pyong-il was shipped off to an embassy overseas. For a member of the royal family, it was like being put out to pasture. Kim Pyong-il would spend the rest of his life living under constant surveillance. Kim Jong-il was happy to have his half-brother out of the picture. But ousting that nuisance wasn't enough. He was hell-bent on weakening his stepmother's power too, just to be safe. So he exploited one of his father's greatest weaknesses. The supreme leader was a notorious flirt, and his son knew he could drive a wedge into their relationship by simply introducing his dad to new women, ladies who could shower him with attention and pleasure. The scheme worked. The marriage between his father and his stepmother frosted over. With Kim Il-sung's attention elsewhere, the woman's influence waned. Kim Jong-il won a battle of attrition. Soon, he was announced the successor. He celebrated by sticking his stepmother's nose in it. In 1975, she was forced to publicly read an embarrassing speech praising Kim Jong-il's dead mother. The stepmom was compelled to call her, quote, an imperishable communist revolutionary fighter and outstanding woman activist. She also had to call her one of the three generals of Mount Paektu and, the biggest insult, the mother of the nation. Soon, the stepmother's relationship with Kim Il-sung completely dissolved. 6 years later, she was placed under house arrest. By the late 1980s, as Kim Jong-il amassed more power, the woman who had tried to cut him down was nowhere to be seen.
But the same could not be said for Kim Jong-nam's stepmother.
On May 1st, 2001, a plane flying out of Singapore touched down at Narita International Airport outside of Tokyo, Japan. Kim Jong-nam, then just 29 years old, arguably near the height of his political clout, stepped off the plane with his family, two women, and a little four-year-old boy. As the family stood in line for immigration, security officials approached. They asked to inspect Kim Jong-nam's passport.
パスポートを拝見させてください.
Like the rest of the royal family, the document was fake. It said he was from the Dominican Republic and listed his name as Pang Xiong, Chinese for fat bear. Officials led Kim Jong-nam into a room for questioning. At first, Jong-nam stonewalled the investigators. Speaking a mix of Japanese and English, an hour passed before he dropped the bombshell that he was the son of North Korea's dictator. He explained that he had come to take his young son to Tokyo Disneyland. He showed them his passport again, displaying stamps proving that he had entered Japan multiple times without trouble. But the questioning continued. Over the next 72 hours, Kim Jong-nam and his family would be kept at an immigration detention center. Word got out fast, and journalists flocked to the airport. Meanwhile, in Pyongyang, officials scrambled to deny the news. The regime, according to Sung Yoon Lee, was growing embarrassed.
Why is that embarrassing? Because North Korea rails against the evils of capitalism, materialism, Western pop culture, and Disneyland nicely encapsulates all of those qualities.
After 3 days, Kim Jong-nam and his family were deported, but not before journalists snapped photos of North Korean royalty making the walk of shame onto an airplane. When Kim Jong-nam returned home, his father was outraged. He disinvited his son from attending a special economics meeting with the Chinese, and he'd never be invited to a high-level event again. 2 years later, the North Korean People's Army Publishing Company released an article entitled, "The Respected Mother is the Most Faithful and Loyal Subject to the Dear Leader Comrade Supreme Commander." The story was designed to deify the mother of the future successor, in the same way that Kim Jong-il's late mother had been celebrated. But the subject of the article was not Kim Jong-nam's mother. It was Ko Young-hee, the mother of Kim Jong-un. To this day, rumors swirl that Kim Jong-un was, in fact, just the beneficiary of his mother's dirty tricks.
There was some South Korean chitter-chatter that it was actually Kim Jong-un's mother who leaked the details about the Disneyland Tokyo trip to the Japanese press in an effort to actively embarrass Kim Jong-nam.
Did Kim Jong-un's mother tip off the Japanese about Kim Jong-nam's travel plans to Tokyo? Nobody is certain. But with Kim Jong-nam disgraced, an international laughingstock, the event certainly helped push her sons to the front of the line.
I came away with the impression that it was because of her efforts to promote her sons that Kim Jong-un had risen to the top.
Kim Jong-il won the battle against his stepmother. Kim Jong-nam did not. Next time on Big Brother, Kim Jong-nam walks a tightrope with his father's favor after putting the regime's carefully protected image in peril. Big Brother is a production of School of Humans and iHeartRadio and hosted by me, Aiden Lee. Lucas Riley is our writer, co-director, and associate producer. Amelia Brock is our senior producer, co-director, and editor. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Our fact checker is Aaron Blakemore. Music composed by Jason Todd Shannon and Tune Welders. Original score mixed by Vic Stafford. Our opening song is Waltz No. 2 from the Second Suite for Jazz Orchestra by Dmitry Shostakovich, as performed by the Ukraine National Symphony Orchestra. Licensed from Naxos Records and G. Shermer, Inc. The North Korean national anthem is licensed from Warner Chappell Production Music. Audio editing by Jesse Neiswanger. Sound design and mix by Harper W. Harris. Special sound credit to Kwama Tu of freesound.org. Audio correction by Josh Fisher. Voice acting by Mark Chung, Jun Yoon, Mike Coscarelli, Sean McKeague, Daniel Kim, Yuri Nam, and Judy Alice Lee. Special thanks to Norikazu and Hanako Goto, Ryan Murdoch, and Will Pearson. Sound licensed from Critical Past. If you're enjoying the podcast, help us get the word out by leaving a rating in your favorite podcast app. Until next time, I'm Eden Lee.
School of Humans.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to season two of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.